continue to send a message to reformers around the world that America stands strong in our belief that freedom is universal and that we hope at some point in time everybody is free. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. President. You talked earlier about the importance of spending discipline in the federal budget, but you went your entire first term without vetoing a single spending bill, even though you had a lot of tough talk on that issue in your first term. And I'm wondering, this time around, what are you going to do to convince Congress you really are serious about cutting federal spending? Will you veto spending bills this time?
Yeah, here's what happened. I submitted a budget, and Congress hit our number, which is a tribute to Senator Frist and Speaker Hastert's leadership. In other words, we worked together. We came up with a budget like we're doing now. We went through the process of asking our agencies, can you live with this? If you don't like it, you know, counter-propose. And then we came up with a budget that we thought was necessary. And we took it to the leadership, and they accepted the budget. And they passed bills that met our budget targets. So how can you veto an appropriation series of appropriations bills if the Congress has done what you've asked them to do? Now, I think the president ought to have a line item veto because within the appropriations bills, there may be some differences of opinion on how the money is being spent. But overall, they have done a superb job of working with the White House to meet the budget numbers we submitted. And so the appropriations bill I just signed was one that conformed with the budget agreement we had with the United States Congress. And I really do appreciate the leadership, not only Speaker Hastert and Senator Frist, but also the Budget Committee Chairman. I talked to Senator Gregg this morning, as a matter of fact, who's running, heading the Budget Committee in the United States Senate. And we're working very closely with members of Congress as we develop the budget. And it's going to be a tough budget, no question about it. And it's a budget that I think will send the right signal to the financial markets and to those concerned about our short-term deficits. As well, we got to deal with the long-term deficit issues. That's the issue that John Roberts talked about, which is the unfunded liabilities when it comes to some of the entitlement programs. Ed.
Morning, Mr. President. I'd like to ask you on Social Security, you said that you don't like to come to the table with having negotiated with yourself, yet you have ruled out tax cuts and no cuts in benefits for the retired and the near retired. I wonder how you square that statement, and also, what is near retired?
Yeah, well, that's going to fall in the negotiating with myself category. But look, it was very important for me in the course of the campaign, and it's going to be very important for all of us who feel like we have a problem that needs to be fixed, to assure Americans who are on Social Security that nothing will change. Part of the problem politically with this issue in the past, Ed, as you know, is the minute you bring up Social Security reform, people go running around the country saying, really what he says is he's going to take away your check, or that which you have become dependent upon will no longer be available for you to live on. And so, therefore, part of setting the stage, or laying the groundwork for there to be a successful reform effort is assuring our seniors that they just don't have to worry about anything. When they hear the debate that is taking place on the floor of the Congress, they just need to know that the check they're getting won't change. The promises will be met. That, you know, if there's to be an increase in their check, they'll get their check. In other words, the formula that has enabled them the formula they're relying on won't change. Let me put it that way. I was trying to be really brilliant. Now, what was the other part of your question?
If I could just follow up.
Did you say follow up or part of the question?
You asked.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. You're right.
Why did you choose to take on Social Security and not Medicare, which some people believe is a worse problem?
Well, I appreciate that, Ed, but we did take on Medicare. And it was the Medicare reform bill that really began to change Medicare as we knew it. It was introduced market forces for the first time, provided a prescription drug coverage for our seniors, which I believe will be cost effective. I recognize some of the actuaries haven't come to that conclusion yet, But the logic is irrefutable, it seems like to me, that if a if the government's willing to pay $100,000 for, you know, heart surgery, but not a dime for the prescription drug that would prevent the heart surgery from happening in the first place, aren't we saving money when we provide the money necessary to prevent the surgery from being needed in the first place? I think we are. That's one of the differences of opinion that I had with the actuaries. I readily concede I'm out of my lane. I'm not pretending to be an actuary. But I know that we made progress in modernizing the Medicare system, and there's more work to be done, no question about it. But as you know, it's a 3-year phase-in on Medicare, or 2-year phase-in from now. And in 2006, the prescription drug coverage will become available for our seniors. And I look forward to working with members of Congress to make sure the Medicare system is solvent in the long run. Let's have somebody new. Mike, you want to? No, you're not new.
On what?
That is a cheap shot. Go ahead. That is generous.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Mr. President,
Mike, welcome.
Since early in your first term, you've talked about immigration reform, but yet people in your own party on the Hill seem opposed to this idea, and you've gotten opposition even on the other side. Do you plan to expend some of your political capital this time to see this through?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, first of all, welcome. I'd like to welcome all the new faces. Some prettier than others, I might add. But yes, I tend to work with members of Congress to get something done. I think this is a issue that will make it easier for us to enforce our borders. And I believe it's an issue that is will show the, if when we get it right, the compassionate heart of the American people. And no question, it's a tough issue. Just like some of the other issues we're taking on. But, you know, my job is to confront tough issues and to ask Congress to work together to confront tough issues. Now, let me talk about the immigration issue. First, we want our Border Patrol agents chasing, you know, crooks and thieves and drug runners and terrorists, not good-hearted people who are coming here to work. And therefore, it makes sense to allow the good-hearted people who are coming here to do jobs that Americans won't do a legal way to do so. And providing that legal avenue, it takes the pressure off the border. Now, we need to make sure the border is modern, and we need to upgrade our Border Patrol. But if we expect the Border Patrol to be able to enforce a long border, particularly in the South, and the North for that matter, we ought to have a system that recognizes people are coming here to do jobs that Americans will not do. And there ought to be a legal way for them to do so. To me, that is, and not only that, but once the person is here, if he or she feels like he or she needs to go back to see her family, to the country of origin, they should be able to do so within a prescribed, in other words, and the card or the permit would last for a prescribed period of time. It's a compassionate way to treat people who come to our country. It recognizes the reality of the world in which we live. There are some people, there are some jobs in America that Americans won't do, and others are willing to do. One of the important aspects of my vision is that this is not automatic citizenship. The American people must understand that, that if somebody who is here working wants to be a citizen, they can get in line like those who have been here legally and have been working to become a citizenship in a legal manner. And this is a very important issue, and it's a I look forward to working with members of Congress. I fully understand the politics of immigration reform. I mean, I was the governor of Texas. Right there on the front lines of border politics. You know, I know what it means to have mothers and fathers come to my state and across the border of my state to work. Family values do not stop at the Rio Grande River, is what I used to tell the people of my state. People are coming to put food on the table. They're doing jobs Americans will not do. And to me, it makes sense for us to recognize that reality and to help those who are needing to enforce our borders, legalize the process of people doing jobs Americans won't do, take the pressure off of employers so they're not having to rely upon false IDs, cut out the coyotes who are the smugglers of these people, putting them in the back of tractor trailers in the middle of August in Texas, allowing people to suffocate in the back of the truck, stop the process of people feeling like they got to walk miles across desert in Arizona and Texas in order just to feed their family, and they find them dead in the out there, you know. I mean, this is a system that can be much better. And I'm passionate on it because the nature of this country is one that is good-hearted and compassionate. Our people are compassionate. The system we have today is not a compassionate system. It's not working. And as a result, the country is less secure than it could be with a rational system. Yes, sir. Let us take it overseas, across the pond.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I wonder whether I could ask you two central questions about the war on terrorism. The first one is, do you have a sense of where Osama bin Laden is and why the trail on him seems to have gone cold? And secondly, how concerned are you by the reports of torture, to use your word, the interminable delays to justice for detainees held in Guantanamo, and how much that damages America's reputation as a nation which stands for liberty and justice internationally?
Right, if I had to guess, I would guess that Osama bin Laden is in a remote region on the Afghan-Pakistan border. But I don't have to guess at the damage we have done to his organization. Many of his senior operators have been killed or detained. Pakistan government has been aggressive in pursuit of al-Qaeda targets in Waziristan. And I appreciate the work of President Musharraf. He came the other day on a Saturday morning to the White House, and it was an opportunity to thank him once again for some of the bold steps he's taken. And al-Qaeda is dangerous, no question about it. But we got a good strategy, and it's a strategy that requires cooperation with other nations, and the cooperation has been great when it comes to sharing intelligence and cutting off finances and arresting people or killing people. And we'll stay on the hunt. And in terms of the second party, the damage, yeah, look, we are a nation of laws, and to the extent that people say, well, America has no longer a nation of laws, it does hurt our reputation. But I think it's an unfair criticism. As you might remember, our courts have made a ruling. They looked at the jurisdiction, the right of people in Guantanamo to have habeas review, and so we're now complying with the court's decisions. We want to fully vet the court decision because I believe I have the right to set up military tribunals. And so the law is working to determine what presidential powers are available and what's not available. We're reviewing the status of the people in Guantanamo on a regular basis. I think 200 and some odd have been released. But you've got to understand the dilemma we're in. These are people that got scooped up off a battlefield attempting to kill U.S. troops. And I want to make sure before they're released that they don't come back to kill again. And so it's important to let the world know that we fully understand our obligations in a society that honors rule of law to do that. But I also have an obligation to protect the American people, to make sure we understand the nature of the people that we hold, whether or not there's possible intelligence we can gather from them that we could then use to protect us. So we'll continue to work the issue hard. Let's see here. Yeah, Hutch. Go ahead and yell it out, Hutch.
Going for another new face, huh?
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to Secretary Rumsfeld. Thank you. You talked about the big picture elements of the Secretary's job, but did you find it offensive that he didn't take the time to personally sign condolence letters to the families of troops killed in Iraq? And if so, why is that an offense that you're willing to overlook?
Yeah. Listen, I know Secretary Rumsfeld's heart. I know how much he cares for the troops. He and his wife go out to Walter Reed and Bethesda all the time to provide comfort and solace. I have seen the anguish heard the anguish in his voice and seen his eyes when we talk about the danger in Iraq and the fact that youngsters are over there in harm's way. And he's a good, decent man. He's a caring fellow. Sometimes perhaps his demeanor is rough and gruff, but beneath that rough and gruff, no-nonsense demeanor is a good human being who cares deeply about the military and deeply about the grief that war causes. Almost running. Bedeans.
Mr. President, President, I want to kick forward to the elections in Gaza in a few weeks, if I could, please. As you know, Presidents back to Carter have searched for a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Your dad worked hard for it. Your predecessor said once it was like going to the dentist without getting your gums numbed. I'm wondering what great...
Guy had a way with words.
I'm wondering, sir, what lesson you draw, though, from their efforts, how you think the war in Iraq may at this point have improved prospects for a Mideast peace, and whether you think you might sit in that diplomatic dental chair yourself this year.
I've been in the diplomatic dental chair for 4 years. I mean, this is an issue we talk about a lot, but it became apparent to me that peace would never happen so long as an interlocutor in the peace process was not really dedicated to peace and or dedicated to a state. I gave the speech June 24, 2002 in the Rose Garden that laid out the vision about how to achieve, at least from my point of view, how to achieve a peaceful solution and something that, I hope happens. But I'm realistic about how to achieve peace. And it starts with my understanding that there will never be peace until a true democratic state emerges in the Palestinian territory. And I'm hopeful right now because the Palestinians will begin to have elections. We'll have elections, which is the beginning of the process toward the development of state. It is not the sign that democracy has arrived. It is the beginning of a process. And we look forward to working with Israel to uphold her obligations to enable a Palestinian state to emerge. But we got a good chance to get it done, and I just want the people, and I know the world wondering whether or not this is just empty rhetoric, or do I really believe that now's the time to move the process forward? And the answer is now's the time to move the process forward. But we cannot shortcut the process by saying, the Palestinians can't self-govern. They're not suitable for a democracy. I subscribe to this theory that the only way to achieve peace is for there to be democracies living side by side. Democracies don't fight each other. And the last system didn't work, which was the hope that a Palestinian authority run by a singular head, who on some days would say we're for peace and some days would say now's the time to attack, hope that everything would be fine. It just didn't work. So I look forward to working with the world, the new Secretary of State, to work with the Palestinians to develop the structures necessary for a democracy to emerge. And I appreciate the fact that Prime Minister Tony Blair is willing to help that process by holding a conference with Palestinians that will help develop the state. And if the free world focuses on helping the Palestinians develop a state, and there's leadership willing to accept the help, it's possible to achieve peace, and there are responsibilities for all parties. Palestinians have the responsibilities. The Israelis have responsibilities. The Americans have responsibilities. The EU has responsibilities. But we all have got to keep the big vision in mind in order to achieve the objective. Listen, thank you all very much. I wish everybody, truly wish everybody, a happy holidays. For those of you coming to Crawford, I look forward to not seeing you down there. Thank you all.
Huh? Going to the Rose Bowl?
No, I won't be going to the Rose Bowl. I'll be watching the Rose Bowl. And by the way, in case you're not following high school football in Texas, attaboy Jackson, the Crawford Pirates are the state 2A, Division II champs. And we look forward, don't we, to wave the championship banner above the Crawford High School. All right, happy holidays.
You've been listening to President Bush hold a news conference live this morning at the White House. I'm Lynn Neary. This is a special report from NPR News.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit the Promenade Gift Shop and Krannert Center Ticket Office during this holiday season. For more information about Krannert Center performances in the new year, visit KrannertCenter.com.
AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Well, good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning in this part of the show. This first hour, what remains of it, we have about half an hour, 35 minutes. We'll be talking with Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday. And we invite your questions on home maintenance. Maybe something needs to be fixed. You have some kind of problem. You're thinking of doing some remodeling, making some changes. Hank knows an awful lot about the single-family home and its various parts. And now, lo, these many years, he's been stopping by every month, and we answer questions. So whatever's on your mind, you want to call in here and talk with him, it's easy to do. Just dial the number 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So we'll get in as many questions as we can. Welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Good to be here.
Anything in particular that you would suggest people be thinking about here now at this time of year? We've had some pretty cold temperatures. We're maybe the coldest we've had since last January now.
Yes, certainly has been that matter of keeping the discharge from your sump pump open so it doesn't freeze up and things like this so that that works. And we're probably almost to the filter change on the furnace time.
Okay.
So I think those are the two important ones.
All right. Well, we have somebody ready to go here with question. We'll just get right to him. The caller's in Indiana on line 4.
Oh.
Yes.
I was wondering about the do's and don'ts of putting the plastic of whatever variety, you know, where it shrinks when you heat it up with a hair dryer or whatever, on either the outside and inside of the house. And what is the best way to do it? I've been told that you should cover the entire window. Then I've been told you ought to get really specific and just do right around the edges and all that kind of stuff. And I just wondered which way is the best way to go on that. We got some houses that are sort of like a summer room where there's not much heat getting to it, and I've been using it, and I thought that at least if I don't do it this time because it's pretty cold, I'll certainly do it, you know, when the weather gets nice, and whatever that temperature is also as far as that goes. Thanks a lot.
Right. Okay, well, basically it works best on the inside because it isn't subject to the wind and getting torn up and so on. It is a good idea to take it all the way to the edge of the trim on the inside because a good portion of the leakage occurs around the window sash itself and in many cases in the window framing itself. So we want to cover as much as possible of that and stop that air leakage. Many times we will even find that the cold air is blowing out around the trim, between the trim and the wall, because it is not sealed behind. The gap between the rough opening and the finished frame is not properly sealed, and we're getting air blowing in there. So as much of the area as your wife will let you cover because of the appearance of it, and the whole thing would be good. And you can realize how well it works when we get a wind coming in and we see this plastic bellying out into the room, mm-hmm. and that's what we're stopping.
If the problem, and I guess on any window, you can have a problem with air leakage around the rough opening, that is the hole they cut in the wall to put the window in.
That's right.
What you may not be able to, you may not really see that. If you want to seal that, do you have to take off the interior trim to really
get
in there?
That is the best way to do it, is to take off the interior trim, use one of the cans of foam or whatever, and seal that. Now, you don't want to fill that gap with foam because the foam will expand enough that you'll bulge the window frame and you won't open the window again. We need to stuff it full of fiberglass or something like that and then use the foam as a sealant on the inside.
Okay.
Even the low-expansion foams will sometimes generate enough pressure to bulge the inside window frame.
Okay.
But yes, that can make a tremendous difference on the heat loss of a room.
Next caller is Champaign, line one.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I have a question about roof insulation. I have a half story upstairs, so there's a small attic, and in some of the rooms upstairs, the ceiling is at an angle because it's right up against the roof. And if I go outside after a light snow or frost, I can see, I guess, melting patterns on the roof where it would appear that insulation is either better at some parts of the roof than others, because I can actually see where some of the outlines of the rooms on the roofs. So is that necessarily an indication that I have poor insulation in the roof?
Well, it means that you probably do not have adequate airspace between the insulation and the bottom of the roof.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to allow air to circulate above the insulation, between the insulation and the roof sheathing. And if you do not, then you will get some melting patterns like this. You'll often see the actual framing members pattern.
Well, it wasn't there. That bad, but I could see framing members. But, you know, it was faint, but I could see some melt pattern.
Yeah. So basically what reason we're trying to ventilate that area is not to worry about the melt patterns, but we may get condensation on the bottom of the roof sheathing.
Right.
And so that's why that area is supposed to be ventilated. Generally speaking, we want vents in the gable ends in that little area above the flat ceiling, or better yet, a continuous ridge vent up there, and then some ventilation into the space in the knee walls where you have the short vertical walls. We need some ventilation there so that the air can flow from that area up above the insulation and out through the ridge vent or the gable end vents.
Well, the house was built about 50 years ago. Is that a construction issue that was commonly addressed back then?
Probably not. They probably didn't do much of anything. What you probably have is just somebody who stuffed insulation up in there and stapled it in place.
Yeah. So is there anything, if there is a improper insulation, is there anything I could do to address that problem?
Basically by putting more insulation on the ceiling and putting a new ceiling surface on it.
Oh, okay. Sounds like a major project.
It is, unfortunately. However, you don't really have a problem unless you are having difficulty with shingle life or roof life above it. You're not getting the insulation that you should have, but you're probably not causing a problem either.
Yeah, because the upstairs rooms are noticeably colder than downstairs. I would think that the heat would be rising, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, okay, it can't rise unless there's a way for it to get out. So therefore, no, it doesn't rise that much. But
that's true. I didn't consider that. Okay, and then one other quick question: Do you recommend those plastic dome basement window well covers? Is that a good idea or not?
Yes, it can be a very good idea, particularly if the slope of the soil is such that water tends to run toward the window wells.
Well, I don't think there is that problem, but does it add extra insulation?
Yes, it does. It's like adding a storm window.
Okay, might be a good idea then. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. The next caller is in Champaign. Also, this is line number two. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Maybe an off-season question, but so in lining my backyard, I have a wooden privacy fence, you know, with alternating vertical boards.
Right.
And over the last few years, it started sagging. Sort of outward onto the hanging over the neighbor's lawn. And I'm wondering why, I'm trying to figure out why it's doing this, because it seems like the supports are intact. And do I need to dismantle the whole fence and replace it, or can I somehow jack it back upright and add new supports? Can you tell what might be happening?
Not really without seeing it. I suspect that the posts supporting it are beginning to rot. And bringing something like that, it all depends. There's a tremendous amount of wind pressure on those things, and the nailed connections in the fence itself can be giving and would let it belly out that way. So without being able to see it, I don't think I can tell you exactly what's going on. But as I say, the privacy fences, the winds we have in this area exert a tremendous amount of pressure on the fence, and you may be able to be, it may actually be pushing the dirt where the posts go into the ground and causing that to belly out.
Okay, but you wouldn't expect it to be an effect where the fence itself is stretching. You think it would be
no.
Like a matter of attachment to the post?
I think it is a matter of attachment and support.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks. Bye. For just now that the caller has raised the subject, a pressure-treated post that you would use for a fence post, for example.
Yes.
How many years of life would you expect to get out of that?
Oh, probably at least 30.
Really? That long? Now,
yes.
And that is, now, what are we talking about as being the recommended way of securing it? We're not talking about – I expect it's not recommended just to bury it in the ground.
Well, you can, or else you can dig the hole and then backfill it with concrete.
With concrete.
And that gives you a lot more area for it to press against the soil. Because if you have the normal 4x4 post and you get that wind pressure in, it's going to move soil.
Yeah.
And I suspect that may be what's happening in this case, because the wind force on a privacy fence is very high.
If you set you're talking about a treated 4x4, if you set that in, if you dig the hole, put in concrete, set it in concrete, as opposed to just digging a hole and putting it in and backfilling with dirt, will you get more life out of your post, or does that not affect
No, you won't get more life out of the post. You might even shorten it slightly. However, it's more likely to stay put.
More stable. Okay. Well, let's go on here. We've got some other callers, and next is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling because I was watching a program about plumbing, in particular about a hot water heater, and this person said that you need a sacrificial anode rod made of magnesium, aluminum, or zinc for hard water in a glass-lined hot water heater, so that this anode rod collects all the, I don't know what, junk, rust.
It corrodes instead of the tank.
Yeah.
And your water heater undoubtedly has one.
What?
Your water heater undoubtedly has one.
Well, don't those need to be changed once in a while, or how do you?
It depends. On some types of water, yes, it would need to be changed. In other types, for instance, in the water we get in Champaign-Urbana, we're used to having water heaters last 40 years.
Uh-huh. 40 years.
In Mahomet, you're lucky if you get 5.
Oh, my gosh, because there's what, so much more iron
The difference in the water.
Yeah. So it sounds like I don't need to have it changed.
I wouldn't think so. There are companies that sell replacement anode rods and so on, but if you are getting water out of the water systems in the cities of Champaign and Urbana, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, well, I don't need to worry till I die.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure thing. Let's go on to another caller. This is someone on line 1, and the caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We're in the process of getting some estimates on a new roof, and we want to retrofit with ridge and soffit vents, as you're always talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys that's been out said that because we have a chimney breaking up the ridge in a couple, we have 2 chimneys, that he would think that we would be better off with those little square vent things that put up near the peak. What do you think of those?
I think the ridge vent is better.
Uh-huh.
If the roofer is competent, he ought to be able to flash a ridge vent into the chimney without any great problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we have an appropriate number of the little button vents, they do work. The main thing is we want to be sure we get enough vents in the bottom of the soffit so that we have enough air flowing up to get out the top.
Uh-huh.
And that, again, is not usually a major problem. It can either be a continuous slit a couple of inches wide that's been screened to keep the birds out, or individual vents. Usually they're about 2 or 3 by 8 inches that they're cut into the soffit. But as long as we have adequate airflow, they're fine. But generally speaking, a combination of soffit vents and a continuous ridge vent provides the best ventilation for the attic.
looks to me like those button vents would be an opportunity to leak and be a nice...
They can be. The biggest problem is snow blowing into them.
Oh. Well, that's exactly why we want to go with ridge vents, because right now we have somebody, previous owner, took out some attic windows and put those louvered vent things in place of the windows, and mm-hmm. you have to board those up in the winter, or you've got an attic full of snow and that kind of thing. We wanted to get away from that.
Yeah. And generally speaking, on ridge vents, the ones that work best in terms of keeping snow out and so on are the ones that have an external snow baffle. In okay. other words, a little lip that turns up uh-huh. on the outside edge. The ones with internal baffles don't work as well.
Okay, so we need to even ask about what kind of ridge vent they're putting in then.
Yeah.
We're out in the country and snow really blows around.
Yeah. Venta Ridge is one brand that has the external baffle.
Okay.
There is one other brand whose name escapes me at the moment, but the external baffles are far superior.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Next caller is Ashmore. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. My question is, when applying aluminum siding around the windows, you are always talking, vinyl siding. You're always talking about having a water barrier up there.
Yes.
Well, I had wood on my exterior, and what I did was bring, I had plenty of insulation at house 6 inches, so what I did is I just brought the felt right up to that, but I brought it up to the wood part of the out part of my trim on my window.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put the vinyl there. Do I need to?
You should have a sealed flashing that connects the trim to the felt. There are several manufacturers that make essentially a sticky back
okay.
Flashing, where you have to peel a release paper off the back,
uh-huh.
and you want to be sure that you go across the bottom first, then you bring the sides down so it laps over the bottom, and then across the top, that flashing has to lap on the top of the side flashings.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right, thank you. The next caller is Aurora, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. It's mm-hmm. nice to talk to you again, Mr. Spies. I wish you and all the people at the station a good holidays.
Thank you.
My question is about the eternal question about hot water heaters, existing ones.
Mm-hmm.
I have three questions to ask. Does it really help to buy a cover for about $25 and put a cover on it?
You're talking about wrapping an insulating cover
yes.
around it.
Yes.
How old is the water heater?
About 6 years.
Probably not. The old ones, yes. The new ones were considerably better insulated when they were made, so generally speaking, we don't get much benefit from them.
So, okay. And is there anything within the $500 range to buy for a new hot water heater that would be worth the $500?
Some of the new ones are direct vent units. They are...
spell that word, direct what?
Direct vent. In other words, they do not hook into a chimney. They go into a plastic pipe that blows out the side of the basement or the side of the house.
And
generally speaking, we're looking at about 90% efficiency on the burners on those. And they will cost about $500 plus installation, which is usually about $200 more.
So if I have a hot water heater that's about 6 years old, it wouldn't pay for me to put a cover on it, an insulating cover?
Don't think so.
Okay. Any other words of wisdom about this?
Where is the water heater located?
It's downstairs on the north side of the basement.
It is in the basement. Okay. That's fine. I doubt very much that installing a direct vent would make a significant savings.
What does the direct vent do?
Basically, we have a fan that pulls the combustion air through the water heater and blows it outside.
How does that make for efficiency in the...
The combustion air, the hot air from burning the gas, is pulled through it a lot better, a lot faster, so on, so we get better heat transfer.
One last question. I seem to have a lot of rust in the water. What can I do to eliminate that, or can I?
Not sure you can. You put a water softener in with a rust removal unit, and that's about the best you can do.
Well, I don't have that item. How much does that cost?
Generally speaking, the softener is in the $300-$400 range.
$300-$400 range?
Somewhere in that range, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right, thanks. Other questions are welcome. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580 with our guest, Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program every month. It's always a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. We didn't quite have our full time today because we were running the presidential press conference, but we've heard from 7 people already, and I'm sure we could get in 5, 6 more, maybe. Maybe not that many. If somebody wants to call right away, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We don't have anybody on at the moment. And in case people weren't quite following the discussion about the higher efficiency water heaters that vent out the side, the big difference here is the old ones were hooked probably into the chimney and vented the same way that people's furnaces probably also vented. And in both cases, what you're essentially relying on is gravity.
Correct.
And on, I suppose, also the fact that warm air rises, and that's the way that the combustion gases and stuff you want to make sure you get out of the house went up the chimney.
And if you have the fan pushing it, you can use smaller diameter tubes with more area, and you get better heat transfer.
So then the idea is then you will have a pipe that will vent by the fan out through the side wall of the house.
Yes.
Does it make any difference where that is located, particularly when it comes to, you know, what direction you get your prevailing winds from?
Not really. Okay. Not really. Anytime the burner is running, the fan will run, and that's enough to overcome any wind effects.
Okay, very good. Now the lines are filled. We'll see if we can get everybody. We'll go next to Champagne, line 1. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at putting a bathroom in my basement. I'm in Champaign in a fairly high area. I have a very nice, dry, full basement. And I'm looking at putting in a full bath, which, you know, stool, a shower, vanity. And I'm debating whether or not I should, like, be tearing up the floor to expand the plumbing or go with what I understand is up-flush technology, like these electric devices that let you...
I wouldn't do either of them.
What could you advise on that?
Basically, there are several units on the market that raise the floor about 6 inches in the bathroom area only that has a tank and a pump under there. An electric pump, not a nut flush type thing that works off of water pressure.
I see.
And those are very efficient. And as I say, you do have about a 6-inch step up into the bathroom.
Oh, that's great. So I certainly have room for that. And I wouldn't have to do any scary,
You don't have to dig up the floor or anything else. And you can connect that into your existing sewer system.
All right. And that's not a problem with the height of the toilet on the first floor or anything like that?
No.
So it all connects to the same pipe, and it should be okay then.
Right.
Great. All right. Thank you.
All right. Good luck. Next, we'll go to Oak Forest, line 4. Hello.
Hi. This is a follow-up on the hot water heater. Ours is only a year old, and it's in a garage and in a closet. Would you suggest a extra insulation on that, or wouldn't
it? No, because basically it's an unheated area. You have a source for combustion air pulling undoubtedly from the garage or a grill in the floor to a crawl space or something like this. So you're not running heated air up the chimney. And again, any of the recently built water heaters, have enough extra insulation built into them compared to what we did 10 or 15 years ago, that adding a blanket to it is not going to help much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Next caller is in Muhammad, line two. Hello. Is there a caller there? Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I have a water heater that's started to make a knocking noise when it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean I need to replace it? Or?
You're losing quite a bit of efficiency. What's happening is that the minerals are settled out in the bottom so that when you turn on the flame underneath it, the hot water can't rise through the minerals fast enough, and it actually turns to steam.
Uh-huh.
And then as the steam bubble goes up and collapses, that's the noise you're hearing.
Yeah, that is kind of what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So there's nothing I can do to clean it out? It's just
You can try opening the valve at the bottom and see if you can flush some stuff out, but I have a feeling that it's not going to be successful.
Okay, so I should replace it then?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Thanks
okay.
a lot.
All right, very good. Urbana is the next caller. This is line number three. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
We have a relatively, actually not even relatively, an old furnace and water heater in our basement.
Mm-hmm.
And they both exhaust up through galvanized piping that then exits through sort of a faux chimney. And at sort of the elbow joint in the galvanized piping that takes the exhaust from the furnace and the hot water heater. And the heat in the house is radiator, so it's a hot water furnace. At the elbow there, it appears we're getting condensation, or at least there's definitely water either coming from top down or from the furnace up.
It's condensing in the pipe and dripping back down.
That's correct, and we're getting corrosion around the pipe, and it's leaking onto the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering where that's coming from and how or if that needs to be remedied.
Well, any time you burn gas, one of the byproducts is water vapor.
Right.
So that's going up, and it's hitting the cold pipe as it's going out and condensing in the pipe and running back down.
Okay.
So you can try insulating the flue. That would help some. Don't know whether that will necessarily take care of all of it or not. Otherwise, it's a matter of resealing. You know, duct tape is good for everything except sealing ductwork. And
Is there any risk to the furnace or to the house at all, or is this pretty much a minor problem that just doesn't look nice?
It's pretty much a minor problem. Now, this would indicate that probably your furnace is not very efficient, and you might want to consider, with the increasing price of natural gas, going to a more efficient furnace.
Okay.
Or boiler, as the case may be. I just replaced the one in my house this year because it was ancient and not very efficient, and figured this was the time.
All righty. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. If people do have an older furnace and they don't have the material that came with it, so they don't have some kind of piece of paper that says what the efficiency on it is supposed to be, is there any way to try to figure that out, maybe based on how old it is?
Generally speaking, if the furnace is more than 20 years old, you're very lucky if you have an efficiency of more than 60 to 65%. Currently, the minimum efficiency that the federal government permits the manufacturers to make requires an efficiency of 78% or more.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are figuring that you're increasing the efficiency 15%, that's a healthy payment toward a new furnace. There are furnaces on the market whose efficiency exceeds 90%. Generally speaking, there is probably $500 or $600 premium over the 78% ones. And much depends upon the amount of heat loss you have in your house. If you have a very well-insulated house, it probably won't pay to go to the very high efficiency because you're not using that much. If you have an old house that's a bit on the drafty side and all this sort of thing, where you're using quite a bit of gas, then it very well may pay at today's gas prices to go to one of the higher efficiency furnaces, perhaps even one of the 90% ones. Mm.
Now, are these, all of these, when you're talking about that level of efficiency, do these also have the kind of venting that the water heaters that we talked about have?
The 90% one does, yes. You will have a direct vent. It will no longer hook into the chimney. And if you have an existing water heater and furnace going into a brick chimney and you replace the furnace, you have to replace the water heater as well, because the chimney then no longer stays warm enough to keep the water evaporated that is produced. And we have enough sulfur in the gas here and the carbon dioxide produced by burning, we get some dilute sulfuric and carbonic acids, which do not affect the brick, but they sure eat the mortar. So that we've actually had cases where an orphaned water heater, in other words, one where the furnace has been taken out of the chimney and just the water heater, the chimney actually collapsed.
Wow.
So if you replace one with a direct vent unit, you have to go direct vent on the other one too.
Okay. Now, if you have as what an earlier caller mentioned, if you have a galvanized pipe that's actually running up through the chimney, that should not be a problem.
It should not be a problem.
And actually, I guess I thought really you weren't supposed to vent furnaces and water heaters into unlined masonry chimneys.
You're not.
Chimneys.
You're not. That doesn't mean
people don't do it.
Of them out there.
I know. Okay. Well, I guess at that, we will finish for this time around. I want to thank everybody who called and also thank our guest, Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, who are being here. He's on the program once a month. It's always on Monday to take your questions on home maintenance. And we'll be on in January. We're talking about perhaps changing his day of appearance a little bit, but I think it'll still be a Monday.
Yeah.
I think. So we'll try and give you as much heads up as we can.
Well, I think they were talking about changing it in February, not January.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case, he'll be here in January and in February. We'll try to give you as much notice as possible because I know there are a lot of people who tune in for the shows. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Our program, Focus 580, we want to thank Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of the show. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Focus is also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up in the next hour, another of our regular guests usually would be here on the fourth Monday, but we're doing her early so we can get her in this month, and that's Dr. Suzanne Trupin. It's our monthly show on women's health. She will be with us in the next part of Focus, so we hope that you will stay tuned. Right now, we'll take a break, as usual, for news and an update on the market. So, again, do stay tuned.
And with this update on the markets coming up on 10:59 Central Time, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. Wheat's higher on the Chicago Board of Trade amid crop worries after frigid temperatures last weekend across the Midwest. The March wheat contract at 307 is up 2 3/4. May wheat also up 2